This is number 0008, the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, and it comes to you right now.
The following program is brought to you in living color.
Now, it's time for an eclectic mix of interviews and some of the oddest news stories you'll ever hear. It's the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder.
Hey there, hi there, ho there. Peter Anthony Holder here with you with another edition of the Stuff File program. This is 0008. And coming up, a full show as usual, we'll meet a guy who owns an interesting piece of history, Hitler's toilet. Needless to say, it draws a little attention.
I wouldn't say tourist attraction, but I surely have been getting a lot of radio requests and interview requests lately. They actually did an article on it in the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer about maybe 8 or 10 years ago.
We'll talk sports betting with Robert Faringo, a sports betting handicapper. Among other things, we talk about better superstition.
Some people will stay away from certain teams on certain days. For instance, there's one guy that I knew back in college that would never bet an ACC team on Sunday. He just would never do it. He would bet ACC teams any day of the week, but he would never bet an ACC team in basketball on a Sunday. Some people, you know, it's just like fans. The gambler is really the fan to the nth degree.
We'll check the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
Plus, we have the return of Stuart Nelman and Book Banter.
I'm Stuart Nelman with a review of the late Ted Kennedy's memoir, True Compass, along with some literary examples of the expression, gone but not forgotten. That's what's coming up on Book Banter.
And by the way, our guest Slater on this week's episode is the aforementioned Stuart Nelman. In addition to being on this program, you can also read his work in the West End Times, and you can find him online at westendtimes.com. Let's get to the stuff, which we have plenty of, because this, of course, is called the Stuff File program. And by the way, you'll notice the slight, subtle change in the name of the show. It used to be called the Stuff File podcast. We now call it the Stuff File program because there is the potential that it might end up somewhere in the world on the radio, and therefore we can't call it the podcast anymore. Also, this show will be slightly shorter than the previous editions. All previous editions were just a hair under 60 minutes at 59 and change. Now the show will be just a hair under 55 minutes, 54 minutes and change, just to accommodate the possibility that some radio stations might actually play. More on that in the future. But right now, let's get to the stuff here on the Stuff File program, which, of course, is still a podcast, and you can still find in the usual places my website at peteranthonyholder.com, the blog that I write, and also on iTunes, in addition to radioforall.net, which is another place you can find the program. But I'm rambling, aren't I? Let's get to the stuff. We start off, ironically, since we have Book Banter in this edition of the program for the first time, we start off with a story about a book, a children's book, a children's author. What could be sweeter? What could be nicer? What could be more fun? Huh? Well, there may be no greater children's book than Maurice Sendak's classic, Where the Wild Things Are. For decades, children over the world have marveled over the story and its amazing illustrations. Now, this week, a movie adaptation of the award-winning book opens in theaters, and reporters from Newsweek caught up with the esteemed author, who gave them some rather shocking answers to their questions. The reporter asked, "What do you say to parents who think the Wild Things film may be too scary?" Sendak answered, "I would tell them to go to hell. That's a question I will not tolerate." The reporter then asked, "Because kids can handle it?" And Sendak replied, "If they can't handle it, go home. Or wet your pants. Do whatever you like. But it's not a question that can be answered. I saw the most horrendous movies that were unfit for a child's eyes. So what? I managed to survive." Wow. He's a children's author. Did I mention that? Yes. The full interview with Sendak and the movie's producers appear in the October 19th edition of Newsweek. Moving right along. Wow. If you live in New Orleans, the bar on what constitutes good news has been seriously lowered. I mean, really. Central City area residents held a celebration because the city went 10 straight days without a murder. Resident Christina Wheaton said, "I feel good because I wish all the crime would stop. It just makes you feel good when you don't hear about a murder." Officials said there have been 149 killings in New Orleans so far this year. Maybe even more since I just said that sentence. And local police and safety experts are warning residents to not let the good news make them lower their guard. How low can your guard be when there's 149 murders in your town in 1 year, and it's only October? Anyway, many residents credit the New Orleans Police Department with the drop in crime. The NOPD started working 12-hour shifts this summer. Officials say they do not know how long the 12-hour shifts will last. The 10-day streak is the longest this year. In February of 2007, the city enjoyed a 14-day respite from violent killings. How does that do for tourism? I don't know. Visit New Orleans and play hide-and-go-seek. Elsewhere, we go to Lebanon, Pennsylvania. Police in central Pennsylvania say they've nabbed a real pothead. They said an officer spotted 29-year-old Cesar Lopez inside a convenience store with a bag of marijuana stuck to his forehead. Investigators said Lopez was seen peering inside his baseball cap early Saturday morning in Lebanon, about 75 miles northwest of Philadelphia. When Lopez looked up, the officer noticed a small plastic bag appearing to contain marijuana stuck to his forehead. Police said the officer peeled the bag off Lopez's forehead and placed him under arrest. He has been charged with drug possession. Authorities say the sweatband of a baseball cap is a frequent hiding place for drugs. Did you know that? Well, now you do. Meanwhile, while we're still on the topic of pot, and more importantly, idiots with pot, in Brant Township, Michigan, one 54-year-old woman has proven that pot just keeps you from thinking straight. She called police to report that two men had broken into her home and stole her marijuana plants. Yes, she actually called police to tell them that. So the police went to investigate and arrested the woman on charges of manufacturing and delivering marijuana. Of course, she claimed it was all for personal medical use, but somehow couldn't produce a medical marijuana card. So now she sits in jail while two other yahoos sit around smoking her stash. This is your brain. This is your brain on drugs. Any questions? Okay. Now, how strong is a marriage? If you can make a choice between your spouse or your pet. In Australia, Vicky Lowring's husband found just how unimportant he was when he gave her an ultimatum. Either your pet crocodile or me. 52-year-old Vicky said there was no way she would give up her 5-foot-long Johnny, which she says is like a child to her. She helped raise the croc for 13 years, gives it the run of the house, and even lets it sleep with her son, Andrew, in his bed. She adopted the croc after it was left on her doorstep in 1996. Her husband Greg said she spent too much time with the pet and has asked her to give it up in a bid to save their marriage, but she refused, so the couple divorced. Ms. Lowring, a trained nurse, said, and this is a quote, "Husbands can look after themselves, but my crocodile can't make his meals." Mm-hmm. As her son Andrew is only 18 months older than the crocodile, she said the experience was like having two children to look after. Well, I suspect as they both continue to age, she'll only have one child to look after, and we'll be reading about her in the stuff file in the future. So, dare I say, stay tuned. On to Korea. A South Korean passenger jet was grounded just after takeoff so that the flight crew could catch a sparrow that was flying around the cabin. The bird got through an open airplane door and was spotted during boarding, said a spokesperson for Korean Airlines. The passengers on the flight were asked to leave the plane as the airline tried to prevent the bird from taking the domestic flight. The bird was captured and set free, said the spokesperson. The flight's 123 passengers were put on board a different plane and sent on their journey, which was delayed for nearly 3 hours. Birds are a growing problem for the global airline industry, with an increasing number of planes getting damaged after hitting flocks of birds, as you know already. Remember Captain Sully Sullenberg? Yes. Anyway, I think in this case, in South Korea, what we're talking about here is not a bird who has got a kamikaze desire to fly into a plane, as in to fly into its engines, but a bird that's just lazy, a bird that doesn't want to fly. And as one of the many airlines in the past used to have as their slogan, leave the flying to us. That's what the bird wants to do. Anyway, on to our first guest on the program. And for this segment, we are really going to the toilet. A porcelain throne that once belonged to Adolf Hitler now gets grease monkey butt on it every day. That's because you can find it at Greg's Auto Repair in Florence, New Jersey. And Greg Kofeld is on the line with us right now. First off, Greg, I gotta ask right off the top, how does someone end up with Hitler's toilet?
The previous owner of the garage, his father, was actually friends with the owner of the salvage yard that disassembled the yacht here in New Jersey.
Okay, so Hitler's yacht was disassembled in New Jersey back in the day.
Yep, in Fieldsboro, New Jersey.
Okay, so he ended up with this toilet. But not only did he end up with the toilet, I understand it's a working toilet.
And sink.
And sink.
Both off of the yacht.
And it gets used every day?
Both of them do.
Okay, now this ended up, it was in the 50s, I understand, that it first ended up in the shop, right?
Yes, I believe it was. He decided to finally put a bathroom in the garage for, I guess, him and the customers, and he decided he needed a toilet, and he contacted his buddy who said he can get him a toilet, and he just basically got one off the yacht for him.
Now, did he initially know at the time that he got the toilet that it was Hitler's toilet, or was this something he found out later?
No, he knew it came off of his yacht. I mean, the yacht was, it was actually pretty well known that it was up in Fieldsboro. A lot of people were, you know, curiosity were going up to see it, see what it looked like, what was, you know. But at that time, pretty much all the Nazi insignias and everything were all taken off of it. The only thing left was just the German writing and stuff on the handles. So, it's not like doesn't have Nazi insignias emblazoned on it. It's just a toilet off of a boat, I guess you'd call it.
Besides the fact, as you just mentioned, that there are no symbols per se, is there anything else about the toilet that is distinctive outside of what you mentioned, the German writing?
The toilet and tank, you know how most of them are together. On a boat, the tank was stationary on the wall and the toilet was bolted to the floor. So, you know, they're separate pieces. That's about the only thing I could say that's different about it.
Now, what kind of notoriety has this been getting? For instance, I know for a fact that this toilet shows up in roadsideamerica.com, among other places. Has this become a bit of a tourist attraction in your neck of the woods?
I wouldn't say tourist attraction, but I surely have been getting a lot of radio requests and interview requests lately. They actually did an article on it in the New York Times and the Philadelphia Inquirer about maybe 8 or 10 years ago.
When most people come to Greg's Auto Repair in Florence, New Jersey, are they aware of the fact that Hitler's toilet is there, or is this something that people just discover when they get there? Do you put any kind of sign up?
No sign. Most of my regular customers know it. The few that don't usually find out about it eventually after coming in a few times if somebody asks to use it or something. So, but most people, it's kind of like a running joke. Don't piss on Hitler's toilet.
Is there anybody on the other side of the coin? Is there anybody who might get annoyed by this?
Never had that. You know, it's more curiosity seekers. They want to come and see what's what. Take a look at it and, you know, see if it's anything special.
since you are getting a certain amount of notoriety, and as you say, it's been written about and it's talked about online, dare I say, have you actually had any tourists show up looking for Hitler's toilet?
Yes. I've actually had, I've been getting phone calls now, too, because people can look up the phone number, I guess, online. But I got a call from Montana yesterday from a young lady inquiring about it.
Maybe it's time you consider turning it into a pay toilet. You can make some money off of Hitler's toilet.
Well, I put the offer out there. If anybody wants it to sink in the toilet, all they have to do is install a new bathroom for me.
So you're willing to give it up then?
Oh, yeah. I'm not looking to keep it.
Because it's been around, as you say, for such a long time. It has it's been in your place longer than it was on Hitler's yacht.
Oh, most definitely. I would actually prefer to get rid of it and have a nice new bathroom than have this old crappy one.
Well, there you go. Maybe it's time to put the word out there. I'll do my part right now. Anybody out there wants Hitler's toilet, you can check it out. I've put the link into the article in Roadside America on my blog and website, so people can find that information there as well. How much do you think you can get for it?
I have no clue. One of my customers, who's a local, who was actually he's a big naval man. He actually collected a lot of artifacts off of the yacht already, and he has a bunch of portholes. I think he may even have like a map table and some other stuff. He keeps wanting it, but you know, like he said, he goes, "I'll give you a toilet to replace it," but that's about it.
Now, again, are you really sure you want to get rid of this? Do you not yourself enjoy a little bit of the attention that you're getting because you have Hitler's toilet?
It doesn't really matter to me. It really doesn't. Sometimes it can be a pain when people want to come see it. You know, it just takes time out of your day.
Well, it certainly is an interesting artifact indeed. I thank you, Greg, for taking the time to talk with us. Do you want to share your address and people, or if people want to trek on by?
Yeah, that's not a problem. It's 437 West 2nd Street in Florence, New Jersey. Zip code 08518.
Greg, thank you very, very much for talking to us on the program, and keep on flushing.
No problem. Have a good day.
Greg Kofeld, owner of Greg's Auto Repair in Florence, New Jersey, the place where Hitler's toilet resides. Again, if you want that address, you'll find Greg's Auto Repair at 437 West 2nd Street in Florence, New Jersey. You can read more about Hitler's toilet on the website roadsideamerica.com, and you could also find a link to that site and its page on the What's On page on my website at peteranthonyholder.com. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
You're listening to The Stuff File, available at peteranthonyholder.com or as a subscription from iTunes.
And still to come on the program, we will talk to Robert Feringo, who is from DocSports.com, about sports betting and superstitions. We'll also check the mailbag, and there's the return of Stuart Nellman with another edition of Book Banter. Plus, we have more stuff from The Stuff File and, of course, an idiot of the day. Speaking of which, we have more stuff right here, right now. Now, for those who used to listen to the regular program we had on the radio back in the day, one of the things you may remember I used to rail against is this whole idea of zero tolerance, that you can set laws into stone to protect society without taking into consideration some situations might have what we call, I guess, a leeway, that if we use common sense, we would understand that sometimes people aren't attempting to break the law. They're doing something that makes absolute sense, but because of some law on the book that includes zero tolerance, they get themselves in trouble. I've got several stories that deal with that, and they're all coming up right now in the zero tolerance category, under different headings. So we'll start with zero tolerance in the caregiver division. The first Sally Harpold knew there was a problem was when the sheriff's deputy showed up at her home in Clinton, Indiana, with a warrant for her arrest. But the evidence was clear. 4 months before, her husband had gotten a cold, and she went to the drugstore and got him some over-the-counter cold medicine. A few days later, her daughter caught a cold, so Harpole stopped at another drugstore and got her some medicine, too. Once the purchase paperwork was matched up, authorities realized she had committed the crime of buying 3.6 grams of pseudoephedrine, an ingredient of crystal meth, but also a common decongestant for runny noses. The law does not make this distinction, says Vermilion County Prosecutor Nina Alexander. I'm simply enforcing the law as it is written. State law limits purchases to 3.0 grams in any 7-day period, you see. Harpole was taken away in handcuffs, and her local newspaper ran her mugshot on the front page with the headline, 17 arrested in drug sweep. She faces up to 60 days in jail and a $500 fine. It's unfortunate, said Vigo County Sheriff John Marvel, whose deputies made the arrest, but for the good of everyone, the law was put into effect. Really? Then the law is an ass. That's all I'm saying. Okay, on to Zero Tolerance Babysitter Division. Lisa Snyder lives next to a school, or at least near a school bus stop, in Middleville, Michigan. A couple of neighbors needed to head to work before the bus arrived, so Snyder said she would be happy to keep an eye on their kids until the bus shows up. But when the Michigan Department of Human Services heard about it, they ordered her to stop watching someone else's kids at her home because that would make her home an unlicensed daycare facility in the state's eyes. To comply with its rules, she must apply for a license to watch the kids, even though she doesn't charge anything. It's crazy, Snyder said. I'm just helping out a couple of friends. She asked State Representative Brian Calley to help, but when he called DHS, they told him to bug off. He has promised legislation to deal with the problem. So let me get this straight. This would mean that, technically, you're running a daycare should you choose to have a birthday party for your child. Think about it. It's a collection of kids. They're not yours. They're in your care. That's daycare, apparently. Okay, on to the headline of Zero Tolerance Magic Division. When Elvira Zatarain, age 49, was stopped for a traffic infraction in Tucson, Arizona, after straying from her lane, she passed a field sobriety test with flying colors. Then, the Pima County Sheriff's deputy asked if he could reach into her car and search it, and also check her purse, and Zatarain consented. He found nothing suspicious in her car, but found a red bag in her purse. Crystals from a psychic to ward off evil. That's what she told the deputy. He tested the crystals for drugs, and the test came back negative, meaning they're not drugs. But he still charged her with possession of, wait for it, an imitation control substance. Prosecutors offered her a deal, plead guilty in exchange for a $130 fine and drug counseling. No way, Zatarain said. She has never used drugs, and the crystals are completely innocent. When she insisted on a trial, prosecutors dropped the charges. The crystals not only weren't drugs, but obviously they're not capable of warding off evil either. Let's hope in the future she's not caught hauling either sugar or talcum powder around. Okay, next up, zero tolerance out of control again. And this is one that deals with a school, and I love ones that deal with schools because they're particularly ridiculous. In another case of zero tolerance out of control, little 6-year-old Zachary Christie has been suspended from Downs Elementary School in Newark, Delaware, for bringing his favorite camping cutlery to school. While at lunch, Zach made the enormous mistake of taking out the combination knife, fork, and spoon at lunch, in violation of the school policy for not bringing in knives. Believe it or not, the school originally said Zachary should spend 45 days at an alternative school for troublemakers. But after a meeting, the board had at least a partial moment of clarity and instead voted to suspend him for between 3 to 5 days. Oh yeah, this makes all kinds of sense. Idiots. Morons. Nincompoops. Can I be any more clear? Apparently I can't for some people. Okay, moving right along. We're off the zero-tolerance situation, although this next story kind of straddles the line with this one as far as people's idea of what should be right and what should be wrong. Now, here's a story about Michael Jackson's father, Joe, and I have to start off this story by stating that I'm no fan of Joe Jackson or the way he handled himself after his son's death. But this story is just ridiculous none the same, and I can't believe that after reading this story, I'm actually siding with Joe Jackson. I never thought I'd do that, but in this case, I kind of have to. It's funny, and it's also sad. Music mogul Joe Jackson, and I use the term music mogul lightly in most cases, has been banned from a German beer festival in Munich because event organizers said he should not be partying after, quote, his child has passed away. Jackson requested VIP access to Oktoberfest, which, of course, as you know, is an annual event that runs for 16 days, but was refused entry by event director Sepp Kratz because he thinks Joe should be mourning the death of his son Michael, who passed away back in June. Sepp said, Michael Jackson's father was desperate to have a seat reserved. I rejected his request immediately. I was really shocked. The man has just buried his son. It's totally inappropriate to celebrate happily just after your child passed away. That's just not right. In short, anyone who has no sense of decency isn't welcome at our place. Really? You know, again, I paraphrase this by saying I'm not a fan of Joe Jackson. I don't agree with most of the stuff that he does. But how a person mourns and where a person mourns and what they want to attend is nobody's business but their own. Really. I think this guy in Munich is out of line, and he too is a moron. He'd probably disagree with all those zero-tolerance stories I just shared with you. Okay, finally, in this section of the Stuff File, here on the Stuff File program, sorry, ladies, conservative Egyptian lawmakers have called for a ban on imports of a Chinese-made kit meant to help women fake their virginity. One lawmaker has even called for the exile of anyone who imports or uses it. Called the Artificial Virginity Hymen Kit, it is intended to help newly married women fool their husbands into believing they are virgins, which is very important in the conservative Middle East, where sex before marriage is considered a huge no-no. Sheikh Saeed Askar, a member of Egypt's Muslim Brotherhood, who is on the Parliamentary Committee on Religious Affairs, said the kit will make it easier for Egyptian women to give into temptation. He demanded the government take responsibility for fighting the product to uphold Egyptian and Arab values. But Marwa Rakha, an author and blogger who writes about dating issues, sees the product as a tool of empowerment for women in a macho Arab culture that restricts women's sexual urges but turns a blind eye to men gallivanting around. Well, at least now you know where they are going to get those 72 virgins from, don't you? Yes. Anybody want to take bets on who's a virgin and who's not? That, by the way, was a little subtle segue, because we're going to talk about betting right now on the program. You know, superstitions are a bit more prevalent in college football than in the NFL. So says Robert Faringo, a sports handicapper who guides bettors on DocSports.com, and he's on the line with us right now. Hi, Robert. How are you?
Not too bad. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. Thanks for being on the program. One of the things I've always been fascinated about sports is there are so many superstitions and rituals that take place in all sports, and I'm just wondering, does that ever come into play when it comes to betting situations?
Well, I would actually say not, just because, as you mentioned, there's such a broad array of superstitions out there, whether it's in college sports or professional sports, that if you were to try to take the time to handicap or to account for all of them, you know, you'd end up with two sides on any play. There are some things that you do take into consideration, such as a perfect example is in college football, big rivalry games. And some of the less superstitions and more traditions that are involved, whether it's, you know, the old wooden bucket or the keys to the city or things like that, you'll take into consideration and give a little bit more weight to those rivalry games when teams are playing for things and for traditions that have been going on for just, you know, 100 years, some even longer.
Are there people that you've come across who bet based on traditions?
I wouldn't say based on traditions, but I've never met a gambler that didn't have quite a few superstitions themselves. You know, everybody is looking for that lucky rabbit spot.
What are some of the superstitions you've come across?
Oh, geez. Some people will stay away from certain teams on certain days. For instance, there's one guy that I knew back in college that would never bet an ACC team on Sunday. He just would never do it. He would bet ACC teams any day of the week, but he would never bet an ACC team in basketball on a Sunday. Some people, you know, it's just like fans. The gambler is really the fan to the nth degree. They are the fan who's willing to put their money where their mouth is in a lot of instances. So it's no different. You know, they have their lucky mug or their lucky jersey, or, you know, they'll go to the certain bar that they go to watch a game every week. Just kind of generic, general things like that that I'm sure a lot of people can identify with.
Now, getting back to some of the teams that I mentioned earlier, I understand as far as some of the rituals are concerned, Clemson University rubs a special rock on a pedestal near the end zone before each game?
Yeah, it's really killing me right now that I actually can't think of the name of the rock. But and I don't want to call it the wrong name, so I'm not even going to try. But yeah, right at the end of, I believe it's the south end zone, they have just basically a rock on a pedestal. And as each player comes out before the game, they give it a little rub for good luck. The University of Georgia does something similar with a little statue of Uga. Uga, UGA, University of Georgia, their dog. There's a little wooden statue, a little stone statue right outside of their stadium that the players will give a little rub on their way into the stadium for good luck. So, yeah, there's quirky little things like that you'll find across the country.
Now, as I mentioned, it's more prevalent in college football than it is in the NFL, but the NFL has some interesting individuals. I understand that the kickers are probably some of the most superstitious players out there.
Well, someone had asked me about this recently, and yeah, that was as best as I could come up with. That's just kind of who I figured and assumed would be the most superstitious, because you have to understand that professional athletes, probably above anything, are creatures of habit. You know, they've gotten where they've gotten to in their lives because of their extraordinary talent, but at the same time, the routine is what gives them comfort and confidence. And on a football field, who is that the most important? Who is more important for that to happen to, whether it's having confidence or feeling good about your routine, than the kicker, who is probably the least involved player in any given game, but at the same time can have the most dramatic impact on any given game.
I was about to say the player who's most inclined to have the most time to think about what he does in the game.
Precisely. So in those instances of extreme pressure, you know, what gives people that confidence is their routine and is those small superstitions that probably they each individually own.
I want to talk a little bit about the organization I mentioned at the top, and that is DocSports.com. Tell us about that.
DocSports is actually, it's a great company. It's a little family-run business. It was started by Doc Mosman, who is actually one of the true legends in the sports betting and sports handicapping industry. He's been at it for, I believe this is his 38th year of sports handicapping, so he goes back to kind of the old school Vegas days. But what we are now is, now we are a team of handicappers. There are actually seven independent handicappers that sell their picks every weekend or every day, depending on the sport, in a variety of sports, everything from World Cup soccer, college basketball, pro and college football, baseball, WNBA, you know, you name it, we handicap it. And what we try to do is just, again, those people that enjoy betting and enjoy putting a little bit of money down, we try and make it more enjoyable for them by winning and by helping them win. That's kind of what we do.
How does one become a sports handicapper?
That's a great question, and I really wish that I knew. I just kind of fell into it. I was a reporter for a small newspaper in New York a few years ago. I moved to Atlanta and got a new job and wanted to get back into writing. So I answered an online ad to write for a website. They were looking for somebody that knew sports and betting. I was like, okay, yeah, I can do that. So it was Doc Sports. So I started writing for them for about a year and a half. I got a really good following, and they really enjoyed my stuff. So they asked me if I would like to handicap, to take that next step when they were expanding their field. And I had booked a little bit in college, and I was a better myself. So it wasn't something that I just jumped into, but, I picked it up there as a profession. It's gone fantastically well, and, I'm really blessed to have had the opportunity, and I like to think I've made the most of it.
There's the yin and the yang when it comes to sports betting. It's something that I think to a certain degree, either in a friendly bet or in a more serious wager, we all do when it comes to sports. It's just part of the culture. And yet on the other side of the coin, there's this negative aspect to sports betting. Need I say the name Pete Rose, for example, that society can't seem to wrap its head around when it comes to is sports betting good or is sports betting bad?
Well, like you said, it's a dual-sided issue. But for me, there's really only one right answer. I actually think that our collective community here in the United States really has embraced sports betting because, like you said, everyone's done it. Whether it's a picks pool in football, for NFL Sunday games, whether it's a March Madness pool, whether it's horse racing, bingo, state-run lotteries, things like that. I mean, gambling is prevalent all over the place. It's something that people do as a form of entertainment. It's something that some people do to maybe supplement their income a little bit. Some people, again, they just do it for entertainment and enjoyment. And really, I feel like it's become a political issue for some people, Republicans, and it's basically been compartmentalized and used as another one of those kind of wedge morality issues, which is, number one, hypocritical, and number two, not reflective of what I feel the greater societal view is on it.
You're not saying Republicans don't bet, are you?
No, I would never say anything bad about them at all.
Okay.
The bottom line is that it's the stance by the government in the last several years, particularly involving online betting, has been the height of hypocrisy. And like I said, it really isn't reflective of where I think we are as a society when it comes to betting.
You mentioned writing. I understand people can see some of the stuff that you write by going to docsportsblog.com. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. You can go to our main site, which is docsports.com. And then we also have kind of a supplemental blog, which is www.docsportsblog.com.
I will check it out myself, and maybe I'll figure out a few things or two as I'm preparing to place a bet maybe on the NFL coming up.
Anytime. Again, thank you very much for the opportunity to come on, and nothing but the best of luck to you with your podcast.
Thank you very much. Take care, Robert.
You too.
Robert Faringo from docsports.com. Again, you can check out the link to the site and also to Robert's blog. You can find all that information by going to the What's On page on my website, which is peteranthonyholder.com, and just follow the links. There you go. You're listening to the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Still to come, Stuart Nullman and another edition of Book Banter. We have a Stuff File idiot of the day, but right now, let's check the mailbag.
Incoming subspace signal.
And first up, I got a message via Facebook from Jim in Connecticut. Jim was actually somebody who used to listen to the radio program online back in the day when I was doing the old radio show. And of course, now that the program is online and other places, this is a show that has an opportunity to get listeners from all over the world. So hello to Jim in Connecticut. He writes to say, it's a great program. Looking forward to the podcast. He goes on to compare this show and its previous incarnation on the radio to a show that Joey Reynolds does in the U.S. That's mighty flattering, Jim. Joey has a great show. I thank you for the kind words.
Incoming subspace signal.
Something else that we have in the mailbag section, although it's something that I saw online, fellow by the name of Jamie Gore wrote a nice little piece on his blog called Madness Brewing about me and the program, so I want to thank him for that. I won't bore you with the details of the very lovely comments, but I am putting a link into my website so that you can find it and read more about it at your leisure. So thank you, Jamie, for those nice words, and I hope you'll listen to this program in its new incarnation and share it with all of your friends. By the way, I started a new Facebook group. It's called The Stuff File. There you go. It's the name of the program, right? For those of you who are on Facebook, if you haven't joined yet, I hope you will. Let's see how we can build this thing into something big. I will also put a link to the group on the website at peteranthonyholder.com so you can find out more information there as well and make it an easy way to link up to the Stuff File group on Facebook. And that's the mailbag for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up, we will have an idiot of the day, also more stuff, and don't forget, Stuart Nulman with Book Banter. Stick around.
What are they saying about if the rains don't cleanse? New York Times bestselling author David Mixner says, as a writer and advocate for Africa, I could not put down Ben Patrick Johnson's If the Rains Don't Cleanse. Aubrey Hooks, the U.S. ambassador to Ivory Coast, says, fascinating and hard to put down. If the Rains Don't Cleanse is CNN breaking news disguised as historical fiction. If people can't put it down, then why haven't you picked it up? If the Rains Don't Cleanse, the tale of missionaries in 1950s Belgian Congo is loosely based on my own parents' lives. It's available online, including Amazon.com and Amazon.ca. I, Ben Patrick Johnson, want you to read this book. My mother, Abidale Johnson, wants you to read this book. Now remember, this is a woman who survived as a missionary in Congo half a century ago. She is tough. Now do not make me send her your way. If the Rains Don't Cleanse, get it now, or deal with my mother. From our studios in Montreal, Canada, and going out to the rest of the world, this is the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder. It's time to crack a spine. The Stuff File presents Book Banter with Stuart Nulman. Once again, here's Peter Anthony Holder.
And yes, we do indeed have him back. It's Stuart Nulman with another edition, the first edition on this incarnation of the program, of Book Banter. Hello, sir. How are you?
Oh, pretty good, Peter. How about you?
Fine. Nice to have you back.
Well, good to be back.
And it's a bit of a condensed version of the show.
Yes, exactly.
Because it's a condensed show in itself. So we have a shortened version of Book Banter. Initially, you'll be on every 2 weeks and maybe even more after the time goes on. But for now, let's reintroduce Book Banter to the world. So what do you have for us?
Well, I think we have a book about Senator Ted Kennedy by Senator Ted Kennedy, a posthumous release memoir, which has been doing very well on the bestseller list, called True Compass.
Right.
And although he died after a valiant struggle with brain cancer in August at the age of 77, Senator Ted Kennedy showed that through a life of privilege, he saw its full share of triumphs and tragedies. He never forgot the people that he served as a U.S. Senator from Massachusetts for 47 years and also being part of the prestigious Kennedy family. Although he never lived to see the book being published because it was delivered on the day he died, I think if he would have been around, he would have been very proud to see how this book came out. It's a well-written mixture of what it's like to be the youngest child of the Kennedy family and what it's like to be a hardworking, devoted legislator within the highest levels of the corridors of power in Washington. And it's written with a great deal of heart and honesty, with plenty of admissions that sometimes, although the compass needle may have veered off in different directions, it got back on track, if you know what I mean. He went through a lot of lengths, flying through small western towns and even riding a bucking bronco to get Jack elected to the presidency, and I guess it worked. And when he was first elected to the Senate in 1962, Ted made his mission to be the best senator that he can be, promoting a lot of pet projects. His biggest one was, you know, improving healthcare, make it more accessible to the people of the United States.
I know people are going to ask, so I'll ask the question right now. Does he talk about Chappaquiddick?
Yes, he does, but it's more of a matter-of-fact kind of approach to it. What happened, he regrets the mistake that he made, but he leaves that judgment of, you know, whether he was right or wrong to the people who wrote about it in the past and who will probably continue to write about it in the future. But it's more of a matter-of-fact approach to Chappaquiddick, actually. Mm. Also, you get a great look at you know, how he became an effective senator and the hard work and the bargaining that he did in the Senate, to the countless hours of talking and listening to constituents and the many hearings and House committee meetings that he had to attend to get all that legislation that he wanted enacted, get it passed. And he also has some great perspectives of different presidents as well. He thought Jimmy Carter was very indecisive and was very damaging. He thought Ronald Reagan led the country in the wrong direction. But he had a lot of great respect for Bill Clinton, actually, and did everything he could to take the sting out of the impeachment process that he went through in 1998. You know, True Compass has that rare distinction of being the only memoir written by one of the children of Joseph and Rose Kennedy. And reading this memoir, it makes one feel privileged to see how fulfilling a life it can be when one shows the right amount of hard work, devotion, service, and love of family. And Ted Kennedy has done all of that and more in True Compass, and it's left a fine legacy to a public life that was well-lived and well-served.
Now, as you just mentioned, he said some things about Jimmy Carter, so I guess that feud that everyone was talking about that supposedly no longer exists will probably continue into death now that he's sort of bashed Jimmy Carter again.
Yeah, but we haven't heard any reaction to that one, so I guess maybe it's long forgotten, but... You know, I guess it was kind of damaging the way he just, you know, was an indecisive president. So it may resurface. You may never know. But so far, it hasn't.
This also seems to be the year of the posthumous book.
Oh, exactly. I mean, it's been a whole trend. I mean, look, Patrick Swayze and his wife, Lisa Niemi, The Time of My Life, just came out by Simon & Schuster. Michael Jackson's memoir, Moonwalk, just got reissued by Doubleday. And also, the late Michael Crichton has a new novel coming out in November called Pirate Latitudes, a swashbuckling tale of... Spanish pirates, English pirates in Jamaica in the late 17th century. So, you know, I guess more popular dead than alive, unfortunately.
Apparently that was something that was found, Michael Crichton's book was found on his hard drive after he died.
Yeah, exactly. And it just reminds you of...
I plan to wipe mine as I die, by the way. My last thing I do is wipe my hard drive.
Well, so no one else will discover maybe that unwritten great Canadian novel, I guess?
There you go.
But that goes back to the 1880s with U.S. Grant, when he wrote his memoirs just before he died of cancer, and he was out of money. And when Mark Twain published the two-volume set in late 1885, sold lots of copies, and in fact restored the Grant family's fortune, they made... the royalties off that book in $1885, $200,000.
Excellent. Well, it's a pleasure to have you back on the program with us here on the Stuff File program. Where can people find you, by the way, besides being on our show?
Well, you can read me every week in the West End Times or go to www.westendtimes.ca and you could read Book Banter every week.
Thank you, Stuart.
You're welcome, Peter.
That's Stuart Nallman with another edition of Book Banter. This is the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder.
This is the Stuff File.
And we're almost done with this edition of the Stuff File program, number 0008. As we wrap things up, a couple of Stuff File stories and, of course, an idiot of the day. We go to Greeley, Colorado. A man who told officers he was a medical marijuana provider has been arrested for allegedly standing naked in a Colorado highway, pounding on passing cars, and spitting at a state trooper. Dustin Robbins, 27, of Westminster, faces 13 counts, including indecent exposure, assault, and driving under the influence of marijuana. Robbins was arrested September 25th on U.S. 34, east of Greeley. Witnesses told investigators he was cursing at cars and hitting some. Two women in their 70s and 80s told deputies a naked man jumped on the hood of their car, broke windows, walked across the roof, and jumped off the back. Damage was estimated at about $1,200. Authorities said Robbins spat at a state trooper who arrested him. Deputies said he told them he was a medical marijuana provider and they found certificates for medical marijuana, but no state provider's license. State officials say records of licensed providers, by the way, are not public. Robbins is in jail under $50,000 bail. Meanwhile, on to Berlin. German police are investigating a chili sauce to determine whether it was so spicy that it was capable of causing grievous bodily harm when used in an attack. Chili sauce. Police took a sample of the sauce from a kebab stand in Bremen's central train station after a kebab salesman threw it in the eyes of a customer during a fight over napkins. Legally, the question of whether the spiciness of the kebab sauce constituted normal or grievous bodily harm must be addressed, local police said in the northern city a week ago on Friday. Officers broke up a scuffle that kicked off after a 23-year-old wiped his kebab-soiled hands on the stand because the salesman refused to give him a paper napkin. The seller responded by flinging a ladle of sauce in the man's face. The victim's eyes became bloodshot, and police are investigating why the napkin dispute even broke out. A spokesman said that both men could end up facing charges. Now, I understand why the kebab owner would be facing charges, because he threw the stuff in the guy's face. But if the other guy doesn't give him a napkin and he's got kebab sauce all over his hand, what's a guy to do? I ask you. Our next story takes us to Kansas. A former Kansas radio executive who admitted that he embezzled to support an addiction to scratch-off lottery tickets won a $96,000 lottery prize. I tell you, you can't trust those radio executives, can you? Prosecutors say the prize money will go toward paying restitution to Paul W. Lyle's former employer, which is American Media Investments. Lyle pleaded guilty to felony theft for embezzling an estimated $88,000 from American Media. It was during his preliminary hearing, September 21st, that Lyle was notified that he had won a prize in a second-chance lottery drawing. The prize included a boat, cash, and tickets to a NASCAR race at the Kansas Speedway. Lyle will be sentenced on November 30th. His conviction carries a sentencing range of 5 to 17 months in jail or prison, but prosecutors say Lyle likely will get probation because he has no previous felony convictions. Gee, I wonder if he'll get a new job in radio sometime. Anyway, let's get to the idiot of the day, shall we?
And now it's time for the strange things adults do. This stuff bar presents the idiot of the day.
A bomb threat called into an answering machine at the Bundaberg State High School in Queensland, Australia, resulted in the evacuation of 75 classrooms full of students, but it was fairly easy for authorities to trace the call. The caller asked school officials to phone him back to confirm that they got the message and left his number. Aaron James Jackson, age 21, a former student at the school, left his real number but denied making the threat until police played the tape with his voice on it. I'm hoping, of all hopes, that when I say former student, that former student is different from graduate. Because really, why would someone call a bomb threat in to a school that he doesn't even go to anymore and leave his phone number for people to call him back along with his real name? There's only one reason, and one reason alone. He's an idiot.
Gee, I'm only a kid, but even I know you're an idiot.
And that's it for this edition of the Stuff File program with me, Peter Anthony Holder. Coming up on our next program, comic book creator Al Bigley talks about his latest project, the new superhero, which is featured in the comic Geminar. And we'll meet a rock-climbing British teenager who escaped death in a cliff fall. His name, Peter Holder. And, of course, Steve Walsh, our man in the heart of America, checking the pulse of the nation, will be back. The website, peteranthonyholder.com, where you'll find information and links on our guests by going to the What's On page. Just look for the corresponding date and podcast number. In this case, it's 0008. Email me at peter@peteranthonyholder.com. You can also find me on Facebook and Twitter. Twitter is twitter.com/PAHolder, and Facebook is facebook.com/PAHolder. That's all the time we have for this edition of the Stuff File podcast with me, Peter Anthony Holder. See you next time. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Stuff File program with Peter Anthony Holder, a presentation of Flying Fish Communications. Void where prohibited, offer slightly different in Canada. For a complete transcript of this program, next time write down everything Peter says.